Public schools are to serve the public good. At least that's the way in which they were constituted. Corporations are established to serve the private interests of the shareholders, and that they must do, and that is perfectly legitimate and reasonable. The problem comes when you try and mix the two together and confuse the special interest with the public interest. And if you look at the advertising directed at children in schools or the various schemes that are directed at schools, you see that there's a self-conscious and willful effort to conflate the two. That we are all in it together. The Tesco really is just like that wonderful dad round the corner. We really just want to play soccer with you. We really just want to do volleyball. We really just want to help you read. Now, there's a very interesting issue here, because corporations in the United States have very successfully removed themselves effectively from the tax rolls. Sometimes for decades. But the corporate public relations departments portray themselves as corporate good citizens trying to create win-win situations in which they make up for the regrettable lack of public funds by offering you the opportunity to eat a hell of a lot of chocolate so that you can get some PE equipment. You see? So it's a little bit like the Marx Brothers routine in a movie called A Night at the Opera. I know, we can save money. I will be your assassin and your bodyguard at the same time. Now, it's a wonderful, wonderful trick if you can have it. So what do you see in schools then, the trajectory of it? Well, selling to schools is not really a problem. We do live in a market economy, and schools need things like chairs. They need things like tables. They need audiovisual equipment. They need chalk. They need books and so on. You know, corporations selling things to schools is certainly not a problem. Where we get into a problem is where we have corporations selling things in schools and using schools as a vendor. Now, there are many, many problems with this. First of all, is your vision of public education a kind of souk or flea market where anybody who has the price of admission can set up a table and teach anything they want? Portray any content they want, and there it is. Ah, well, I see. Okay, you're Corporation X. You've got this amount of money. There you are. Put a nice linen cloth on your table. You go right ahead into the school. There it is. Go right in. It's a kind of financial decision-making process. There you are, kids. Life is just a bazaar. It is like a shopping mall. The curriculum here is the curriculum created by the marketplace, and that, of course, is created by whoever can afford a table at our lovely souk that we used to call a school. So there's the problem of that, and the problem of the distortions that it creates within the school curriculum. Now, we're told that Ireland needs to compete in world markets. You probably heard that, eh? We've been hearing that in the States for so very long now. It's like 1984, you know. It's like, okay, who's the object of hate week this week? We've been through Mexico, Thailand, Japan, Cambodia, Indonesia, Korea. we've had national sort of economic hate week in the United States nonstop for about 30 years now. You know, so who should we be afraid of now economically? And so then we say, but you know, and the reason that we're not competitive is because our schools really aren't up to scratch. I mean, the schools basically stink. And that's pretty much why it is. And so schools have to be better, and these little rascals have to buckle down, and they've got to perform, and we've got to measure and sort. You know, education policy in the States is run by people who believe that by weighing a sheep, you can fatten it. And so when you think about it, it's, and so you have this, how do you have, on the one hand, this rhetoric of international competitiveness, the seriousness of schools, the need to test and test and test, the stakes have to be higher and higher, the students have to work harder and harder, that with, well, I'll tell you what, kids, let's take 20 minutes now to look at this curriculum brought to us by this corporation. Well, I'll tell you what, I'd love to teach you your maths, but I really don't have time right now because I've got to nip off down to this special offer thing here, so see if I can't get us a soccer ball, you see. So how do you equate the pressure at the macro level for economic competitiveness and the seriousness of schools, which creates distortions in its own right, but which is another story, with the obviously trivial intervention of all of these various schemes, this incoherent clatter of schemes, which are driven not by the curriculum or any curriculum imperative, not by any vision of the child and what the child may need, but by the marketing imperatives of the corporation at the moment. So to let it in is to open the door to chaos. It's to open the door to chaos, at least in a curricular sense. It obviously undermines and corrupts the school, because if you let one corporation in, how is it that you keep another out? On what basis? What is your basis for keeping a corporation out? Schools have become, in that respect, a kind of commercial free fire zone. I actually was asked to speak once at an organization called the Plastic Bag Association. Not your usual academic venue. That was quite interesting. They sent a limousine to Milwaukee, where I was at the time, and drove me to Chicago, I think, to portray Satan. So there I was, this skinny, bearded academic Satan, telling them why it was awful that the Plastic Bag Association was trying to put its curriculum, I mean, you may not have known it, but there's an awful lot to know about plastic bags, trying to put its curriculum in the schools. And I got through with my satanic rap. And then at the end, one of the fellows raised his hand, and he said, "Professor Molnar, I want you to know that I agree with everything you said." I thought, my God, he's going straight to hell. I agree with everything you said. And I said, okay, he agrees with everything I said. He said, "But here's the problem, you see, Professor Molnar. The Paper Bag Association has a curriculum. And if we're not in there, if we're not in there with our curriculum, the kids are going to think paper bags are good and plastic bags are bad. And we can't let that happen. So we are compelled to have a curriculum because our competitor has a curriculum. And that's what happens, excuse me, if you let any of it in the schools. What is your criteria for leaving it out?" Now, quickly, because I have only one Irish minute remaining, and so I'll take some liberties here, and say, so we have marketing in schools, but now in the United States, and you see it here as well, I suspect, the marketing of schools, the schools themselves translated into a commodity. So education isn't a process. Education is a product to be bought and sold. And it's a strange product indeed, because in my understanding of genuine education, at the third level anyway, this is a product in which people are told things they don't want to hear very often. Uncomfortable things, unsettling things, challenging things, things that sometimes make them unhappy. Now, you won't find that on the mall. So how does a product that says, you know, you're going to be unhappy a lot over the next 3 years, because you're going to be poked, prodded, challenged. Your values are going to be questioned. Your ideas are going to be stressed. Isn't it just much easier to go and buy some peach shampoo? I mean, nobody says, look, you got to think about this, man. I mean, raspberry or peach, it's a big deal, right? The marketplace is a wonderfully, wonderfully seductive place, because it says everybody can have exactly what they want. And higher education says, no, you can't. That the truth is one with great difficulty. Excuse me. It's one with great difficulty and only uncertainly and tentatively. That the things that you most hold dear may be things that you can't sustain over time. Bring the marketplace to the third level and destroy that conception of education. Because inevitably it must. It must stifle innovative thinking because of the demands of the market at the moment for the fastest possible return on the least possible investment. It must suppress dissenting or unpopular views, because dissenting and unpopular views make people unhappy. They challenge the idea that this way is the way and the only way. The market is the one true God. And it closes down, and perhaps most importantly, in my mind anyway, it closes down the possibility to have an informed, difficult dialogue with people who believe and think differently than yourself. And it's the only opportunity that I'm aware of that allows democracies to evolve peacefully instead of breaking down into sectarian violence. It is difficult, challenging dialogues with people with whom you have profound disagreements in a variety of ways that allows democracies to be peaceful instead of violent. Lose that and lose the ability to change and evolve and be better than we are without recourse to war and to violence. And so in some respects, marketing, advertising in schools, these various schemes for vouchers and so on are trivial, laughable, a curriculum for fruit snacks that you bite onto and you're supposed to compare to erupting geothermic phenomena, is one of my favorite, gushers, fruit snacks. And you say, well, why would anybody spend any serious time thinking about this? I think we must spend serious time thinking about it, because I think the future of our democratic civilization is at stake in this discussion. And that schools at the first, second, and third level must be retained as public spaces from which the self-interest, mercantile interest of corporations are held outside. They can make many contributions, but they cannot direct and control and influence and manipulate the education of our young. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, for that talk, Professor Molnar. We have some time now for questions. We have about 10 minutes or so, perhaps a little bit less. So if anybody would like to ask any questions, just fire ahead.
Yes?
I'll stand up here, sir.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Professor Molnar. I have two questions. The first question is, if you might speak for a few moments about the experience in Arizona State University of microprose, how that influenced pedagogy. The second question relates to teacher or educators. If we in universities, schools of education, begin teaching or educating future educators through curriculum in the classroom, and then that young person goes into the classroom, don't we increase the possibility of that young person being marginalized by being amongst educators who are not taught the question?
Well, those are two very difficult questions. One difficult because it's very personal. What do I think of Michael Crow? I think Michael Crow is the apotheosis of the marketization of education. I think he is the most evolved form. And I think it has begun to shape Arizona State University, and let me give you one specific example in this way. I understand that you've recently been ranked 59th best university in the world by the Chinese. Is that it? They're here at, is it 59? 53rd, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to take anything at all away from you. I don't even know if ASU made the ranking, so believe me, I stand humble before you. What? 57 varieties, that's it. I was sort of falling into an old Heinz commercial. And so in the United States, we have the U.S. News and World Report rankings of colleges and universities, which have been driving college administrators mad, to drive up their rankings and this and that. I can report to you that I think the education policy program in which I'm a faculty is 9th rated in the U.S. News and World Reports. I have no idea the mystical process by which it was so ranked. One of the things that's important in that ranking I've come to learn is the size of undergraduate classes. President Crow has gone to the Board of Regents and arranged so that if the rankings go up in the U.S. News and World Report survey for ASU, he will get a bonus. Sounds appropriately corporate, doesn't it? Within months of his having done that, he instituted by fiat a new undergraduate course with a limited enrollment and simply dropped it on top of the faculty, which is a matter of some considerable dispute right now, because it appears that he has a direct financial interest in having done that by virtue of this bonus agreement that he made with the Board of Regents, and he completely and utterly obliterated the faculty governance procedures in place for approving courses. In other words, he operated outside of the law, if you want, in doing that. So it's very controversial at the moment at Arizona State University. Very controversial indeed. Now, the second question is a perennial question. I mean, I grew up in a Department of Curriculum and Instruction and spent a lot of time in observing in schools. And of course, you're always on, and I don't know that there is an answer to that question is where I'm going to wind up with this. Because on the one hand, you always, and it's as a parent as well, you want your child to do well in the world that is. At the same time, you recognize that the world that is a terribly flawed place, and you would like in some way to improve it. So too in teacher education. You want teachers that are capable of surviving in the schools that are, but you'd like to believe in your heart of hearts that you've educated them to transform those schools going forward. And so the unsatisfying answer to your question is, I don't know the answer. In my own practice, I always attempt to do both. I always attempt to provide students with the knowledge and the skill they need to survive in the schools and to do well in the schools as they are, but not at the cost of observing critical opportunities for changing those schools. That's what I try to do, imperfectly.
Hi, Alex. I was mentioned competent for commercial education. I'm also a primary school teacher. Let's thank you for the fantastic speech you gave, which set kind of the tone of and the great analysis of the motivations of these companies and why they care. So my question is really, now that we have some understanding of that and it will be brought up through the day, what would your advice or perspective be on the way to move forward, seeing as we have so many supporting organizations? How can these organizations work together to give a coordinated response to this onslaught in the corporate world?
Well, there's obviously in this issue a lot of different discussion and debate, as there always is in any pedagogical or political matter. So the argument is frequently along the lines of, well, do we negotiate and try and regulate, or do we simply ban? And I would say we simply ban. So if I were to offer advice, it would be to draft legislation to make schools ad-free zones. It simply can't be done. And this doesn't make it illegal for corporations to anonymously leave money, euros in a brown bag, on the schoolhouse stoop. It doesn't make it illegal. Public-spirited citizens have always found ways to give money, and sometimes even without recognition. I mean, it used to be called charity. You know, charity, when I was a child, charity used to be where you gave something with no expectation of return whatsoever because it had nothing to do with it. Corporations don't give charity, man. It's business. It's business. So a simple test of it is to simply say, just give us the money. Now, in the old days, back when I was a child, that used to be accomplished through taxation, you see. I have this emotional reaction to sort of going to corporate barons as if they were medieval masters on bended knee saying, by your leave, sir, may I have another bowl of porridge? It seems to me that the most straightforward way to fund public education is through public resources, and that means good corporate citizens should be clamoring at your legislature demanding to pay higher taxes to support the public schools. It's kind of shocking in a way that they're not there. They're not in the United States either. They must be talking to one another, do you think? I'd ban it.
Take just one more question.
Did you have a question?
Sorry. Well, thank you, Professor Molnar, for an incredible, incredibly informing discussion. And also just want to say thanks to the organisers for providing this very important opportunity to discuss this. My name is Tina McFay. I'm from the People Before Profit Alliance. And just to say that we also support this initiative. And I really just wanted to give you an example of a... You mentioned how families believe whatever comes home in the school bag, you know, as being in the best interest of their child. And this is a personal accident insurance form that my son was sent home in his school bag. A quick Irish moment to talk you through the main exclusions. And bearing in mind that these are school children that this insurance is for, it says that the main exclusions are whilst engaged in or taking part in military, air force or naval service operations, directly, indirectly causing or contributing to intentional self-injury, disease or natural causes, suicide, provoked assaults, dueling or fighting, occasioned by or while incurred while in a state of insanity or while engaging or taking part in aeronautics other than a passenger. So, you know, you're asking in whose best interest is this insurance form being sent home? By the time you've insured your child and gone through all of the main exclusions, you're really insuring your child against, you know, for nothing. So just to give you an example, well, if you'd like to have a copy.
Insurance. That could have been written in the States. That's a great insurance policy. Now, so what is your objection then?
Say it again. Well, my child is engaged in all of these activities, I can assure you.
Oh, that's a funny one. Well, do we have time for one? No?
Just about.
All right, we have... Well, you see, GATS is a perfect example of the translation of education into a commodity that can be sold on international markets. And one of the things that they're mad for developing in the United States is the education industry, so-called. And in the GATS, at least by some analyses, the pressure is all in the direction of private provision. It's away from public provision of so-called educational services, so it favors privatization. And anyone interested in, for example, and I would think that this would be particularly in play at the third level most immediately, but it is also true at the first and second levels, anyone interested in the privatization of public resources such as education would do well to take a long, hard look at GATS and similar international arrangements. So the state of play, when last I looked, which was 2 years ago, was very strongly in the direction of privatization and the commodification of education in the form of services bundled and packaged and sold, just as a trading commodity.
Okay, that's the end of this session. I would just like, if you would all thank Professor Molnar again, please. Thanks. There's now a quick coffee break, and I would appreciate if people could be back here by 11:20. Thanks.